in the Pledge of
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right. We did not have a closed session tonight, so there is no report on closed session. And we'll move right on to public comment. This portion of the agenda allows the public to speak to the board on various issues not itemized on this agenda. A member of the public may also request that a matter appearing on the consent calendar be pulled and discussed separately. Pursuant to the Brown Act, the board may not take action on any item that does not appear on the agenda. Each speaker is limited to speak for a period of 3 minutes regarding each item on the agenda. And that comes up. Each speaker is limited to speak for a period of 3 minutes during the public comment portion of the agenda regarding items of special interest to the public not appearing on the agenda and are within the subject matter of jurisdiction of the Board of Commissioners. The 3 minute time limit may not be transferred to other speakers. And the 3 minute time limit for each speaker may be extended by the president of the Board of Commissioners or the presiding member of the Board of Commissioners at the regular meeting of the district. Does anyone care to make public comment tonight?
Can we do that now or later?
Right now, I'm inviting people to make public comment on items not on the agenda that are under the subject jurisdiction of the Board of Commissioners. Yeah. So if it's something that's appearing on the agenda later, you'll have opportunity for comment at that point. All right. Seeing none and none online, Mindy. We will move on to the consent calendar. May I have a motion to adopt the consent calendar?
I'll make a motion to adopt it.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed or abstaining? All right, consent calendar passes. Moving on to communication reports and correspondence received.
Yeah, we'll get right into reports. We have no correspondence received. That's technically weird. So I've attended several community meetings this past month, including giving some presentations, mostly participation this particular time, but there's a lot of presentations coming up for the next month, starting tomorrow with the Mattaquette Cruise and supporting. Let's see here, the Chamber Foundation. This is part of the Eureka Chamber of Commerce, something that we've done for quite a number of years now. So looking forward to doing that. We've our number two of four staff development workshops that were part of goals that we set earlier this year. Those are going very well with Jillianus James. Two more coming up. And another workshop that I attend on a recurring basis, this last one was really interesting. It's about turning dredge spoils into lightweight concrete. Dredge spoils are one constituent in a bigger piece, but they're finding more and more uses. I don't know that they're applicable necessarily here in our area or that we have an opportunity for dredge spoils, but it goes to show you that beneficial reuse is really becoming the mainstream for dredge material. So very positive for all of us. Had a field visit on Tulawat for our Spartina removal process. We're just at the project midpoint. There's a lot of great reports coming out. Right now, success criteria is very high. And we're ahead of the treatment schedule, believe it or not. So there'll be probably a presentation to the board on this. I'd hope to have it in August, but it might not be till September. But we're going to have that group come and present to the board. There'll also be representatives from Caltrans. And hopefully our tribal historic preservation officer will come as well. Invitations have been sent. We're trying to land on a date that works for everybody. There's a barge inbound very soon for a load of chips from Green Diamond Export Dock, which will go up to Washington. And then there's the Army Corps of Engineers dredge schedule. So as you know, we've been moving along with the dredge schedule. The Oquinna was in and completed their federal channel work in a small knockdown near the barn entrance. The Army Corps dredge Etzions came in at a significant amount of barn entrance work in preparation for Manson West Coast dredge copper or Manson Bayport, which is from the West Coast dredge copper contract work. The bulk of the material from the Essions was placed for near shore placement, so those are redundant. I've shared these in the past. Right now, the West Coast Dredge Hopper contract dredge Manson is here. It's leaving tomorrow. It's done about 50% of its volume, and it is scheduled to come back this fall. We don't have those dates yet. This again has been a very positive Dredge episode. We've gotten a large amount of material out of here with the work that the Hessians did and Manson coming in and hitting their 50%. We appear to be going into very good shape come this fall and winter. There is this weird little thing happening in the weather. Hopefully the rains hold out until the Dredge comes back. But it appears, provided they get back timely, we'll be in pretty good shape. So that's the report for now. I'll pass it on to Rob.
Good evening, board. Last board meeting, I was in Baltimore at the MyTags facilities, the Marine Institute for Technology and Graduate Studies, to participate in the ship traffic modeling for the terminal project, which will come to you in detail in a future meeting. But I can't speak highly enough of that facility. If the district ever has the opportunity to participate in anything they do, it's definitely worthwhile. A lot going on there for the district to learn from. And other than the terminal project, I don't have anything to report.
Do we have a district council report?
Nothing for me tonight.
Treasurer?
Lindsay will be here on the 16th. We have a special meeting on July 16th to adopt our budget. Lindsay was in today. We had quite a robust conversation, but she'll be here next week.
Great. Thank you. Mike, engineer report?
I think the main thing will be with water. Yeah, sure. Terribly. We'll be brief.
Chairs. Primarily will be pending approval of the budget will be coordinating of the stormwater treatment system at Fields Landing. That'll be upcoming, and then reviewing the draft phase one report for the RMT for the heavy left marine terminal are the primary things.
Thank you.
Questions?
Yes, if you have any questions.
Might we have an opportunity to go on a field trip and look at that stormwater facility that you've been working on for the district at Fields Landing? It'd be nice to see it at some point.
Right, when it's constructed, yes.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I know it's not constructed yet.
Yeah, so it has to go out to bid. So that's where we're waiting for approval of the budget, and we'll go out to bid for the underground work.
Right.
Thank you.
And a report? We do.
Yeah, mine's brief too, but just continuing to review and coordinate some Harbor District permit renewals and permit tracking. Did submit the subtitle Mariculture Pre-Permitting CDP Renewal additional information to the Coastal Commission. So we'll be checking in back in with them soon to follow up if they need anything else. Working on compiling some GIS data for aquaculture throughout the bay, and then reviewing the Humboldt Bay Area Plan, the county's draft that's available right now.
Okay, moving on to commissioner and committee reports. Start over with you, Aaron.
Nothing for me this evening.
I thought I promised you had a report for us tonight.
I'm saving it for next time.
Okay. Greg?
I just met today with the finance committee, and we went over the budget for 2026 through 2027, and we'll be presenting that at a special meeting on the 16th of July, so a week from tonight. We'll be going over all the budget, and it's a robust one, and it's worth the public coming. Although we did put it on a night, but not this one, so we didn't make you listen to budgetary talks if it's not your thing of interest. But follow the money is always worthwhile for the public. Where's it coming from, and where's it going to? Just so you know that's coming up. Mm-hmm. I just want to apologize to the commission for not being able to attend the Arcata public meeting. I was in Ireland visiting my daughter, there, and it was, you know, it was Humboldt on steroids in terms of weather and greenery, and it was awesome, and you know, brought a lot of fairy energy back when touched a lot of sacred stones. And speaking of fairy energy, I don't often say this. This is not a district business, but over at North Coast Rep, the Cabergay show is going to be this week. And if you never want to see me, if you can't unsee me in drag, don't come. But I will be letting it all hang out at this particular show, and singing with my daughter will be especially lovely. So check that out. I've got handbills if you need them. All right, that's my report.
Did you pre-plan that segue with the fairy energy?
I didn't. No, it just sort of came.
It was smooth.
Nice shirt. I like the color.
Thank you.
Jack?
Yeah, I attended the public hearing. That was public meeting. That was great. I think it was very well put on, and love the community outreach and a lot of the presentations are in information or questions from the public. So I think there's a lot of folks that are eagerly to be engaged and appreciate all the comments and. I enjoyed it.
Great, thanks. Yeah, I unfortunately also missed the community meeting. I was down in Southern California at the California Climate and Energy Collaborative Forum, which is a annual forum put on for various entities and small governments, local governments, doing energy efficiency, electrification, workforce development, and other types of projects like that. So it was really rewarding. A lot of interest what we're doing up here in Humboldt County. Was joined by a colleague from the Blue Lake Rancheria to present and be on a panel about community collaborations and that type of work. So that was really rewarding. But nothing else to really report other than I heard so much positive feedback from so many different people on the community meetings. So thanks everyone who's involved in that. All right. So if there are no additional reports, we'll move on to unfinished business. Item 6A, receive status update regarding the Humboldt Bay Offshore Wind Heavy Lift Marine Terminal Project.
Thank you, Chair. Let's see here. So we've got quite a lot going on tonight. Just an FYI, Marine Geotech will be in the bay starting next week for several weeks. So that's a large vessel that'll be drilling down 100 plus feet into bay sediment to determine what is required for the structural engineering of the wharf. We had a public meeting, which the chair of our community advisory committee meeting will talk about tonight. We kind of duplicated that meeting several nights later in the town of Samoa at the Women's Club, just an FYI there. And then we have an upcoming workshop with the town of Samoa that you'll hear more about later. I get a lot of questions lately, is offshore wind really happening? And while it is being disrupted in the US, the rest of the world is really cruising with offshore winds. China just installed the largest wind turbine in the world, 16 megawatts. It can power 4,200 homes alone just by itself. There's a lot going on in China, as you'll see in a moment. So that 16 megawatt is only 886 feet. Our project has been saying 1,100 feet, so we're still planning for turbines that don't yet exist. This is not planned, this is deployed. So this is the total number of operational wind turbines in the water in the world. UK and China leading, with China pulling ahead of everyone else, and that their proportion will continue to grow. This is projections into the future by various nations. The US is a tiny blip in here. We're being left behind in global renewable energy deployment. This is offshore wind capacity. China at 1 terawatt, the US at 6 terawatts. So we have 6 times the capacity of what China has. Other nations around the world have a lot that's floating. This is fixed at 2.4 terawatts and China at 1. So we have significantly more capacity than most other nations. This is also an evaluation, or you know, just a different way of looking at the total deployment of offshore wind around the world. China being green, Europe blue, everyone else in the world being pink. So this is what actually exists. So you can see China took this seriously starting in 2016 and had a major surge in 2021. And with that, I'm going to pass it to Sally with ICF, who is the lead for the project's CEQA team. Sally, you out there with us? Yes, she is. Yes. Sorry. She'll be our only virtual speaker tonight.
Hi, I can't do video. Apparently, video's been disabled, so you'll have to listen to me but not see my face. I guess I dressed up for nothing. Hi, I'm Sally Zeff. I'm with ICF, and we are the environmental consultants on the team working for the district, and I'm the project manager for the environmental document for ICF. And I have a presentation, which I believe you can see because Rob is running it. And this is a very general presentation about what is CEQA, because I wanted to cover everything. I have given this presentation already to one of the citizens committees. And so you may know a lot of this, and then I'd be happy to take your questions as well. So what is CEQA? CEQA is the California Environmental Quality Act. It was the first state law that was modeled after NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act. And California is one of only 16 states that have such environmental regulation. It was enacted in the 70s. And CEQA introduced the concept of environmental impact assessment to state and local planning in California. CEQA is a process, not a permit. Sometimes people say, we got to go get our CEQA. But it's a process that is required to inform decision makers and the public about the environmental effects of a project before that project is approved. And so the CEQA process neither approves nor denies a project, and it provides that information. Next slide, please. So what are the objectives of the CEQA process? They are disclosed to decision makers and the public, significant environmental effects of the proposed project, identify ways to avoid or reduce environmental damage, prevent environmental damage by requiring implementation of feasible alternatives or mitigation measures, disclose to the public the reasons that an agency is approving a project which has significant environmental effects, because that happens all the time, and foster interagency coordination and review of projects, because other agencies are involved in the CEQA process, and then enhance public participation in the planning process. Next slide, please. What are the topics that are considered in CEQA environmental documents? So this is the full range of topics that are identified in the CEQA checklist, which is an appendix to the CEQA guidelines. So you can see, I'm not going to read this whole list, but you can see that it's really broad. It ranges from visual impacts to wildfire and everything in between. And who are the key participants in the CEQA process? The lead agency is in the middle, coordinating with all of the other participants. And the lead agency for this project is the Harbor District. Then there are agencies with jurisdiction by law, like the Coastal Commission. There are responsible agencies, which are those agencies, those state and local agencies that would have to issue some sort of permit or approve something in order for the project to go. There are California tribes who have their own legally defined role in the CEQA process. Trustee agencies like the State Lands Commission. Project applicants, although in this case the district is its own applicant. Environmental consultants like me and my team. Concerned citizens and organizations, anybody who's concerned. And then off to the side on this diagram is the courts, because CEQA is enforced by the courts. Next slide, please. The lead agency is really the key to the whole process. The lead agency runs the CEQA process, and it makes all the decisions. The lead agency decides what type of environmental document is going to be prepared. Is it a negative declaration? Is it an EIR? In this case, an EIR. What are the studies that need to be done? And then the significance of the impacts that are identified. The lead agency is responsible for preparation of the environmental document, And any outside work, like consultant work, has to reflect the independent judgment of the lead agency. When resolutions are brought to your board for approval, there's going to include findings that all of the work has been reviewed, and that the final judgment reflects the independent judgment of the lead agency. And it's the lead agency that's liable in any litigation related to the CEQA process. Next slide. Responsible agencies, as I said, are state or local agencies other than the lead agency that have discretionary approval power over a project. Because CEQA is a state law, this doesn't include federal agencies. The responsible agencies have to use the lead agency's document for CEQA compliance unless a couple of unusual things occur. One is the responsible agency sues the lead agency over the adequacy of the environmental document, or by the time it gets to the responsible agency's decision making, changes have occurred that require preparation of a subsequent document. The project has changed, for example. California Native tribes are required to be offered the opportunity to consult during preparation of an environmental document. The tribal consultations are government to government, so from the government of the tribe to the harbor district in this case. Each tribe consults independently, not as a group of tribes. And the tribes are considered experts in the field of tribal cultural resources. The lead agency has to consider evidence presented by any tribe in determining whether tribal cultural resources exist. And then during consultation, mitigation for impacts on those tribal cultural resources and alternatives to avoid or reduce impacts on those tribal cultural resources should be discussed in consultation, and they may be agreed upon. They may not be agreed upon. It depends on how the consultation goes. Information provided by a tribe during consultation is not a public record and must be held in confidence by the lead agency. In mo many cases, a tribe requests that everything related to tribal consultation be confidential. Next slide. And then the public involvement in the CEQA process is extremely important, and one of the purposes of CEQA. The public is involved at key points in the CEQA process for an EIR. The first point that's coming up, and we'll have a diagram about schedule, is scoping. So when the lead agency, the Harbor District, issues a notice of preparation of an EIR, that's scoping, and the public is asked to comment on the scope of the EIR. And then the next big opportunity for public involvement is when the draft EIR is issued for public review, and the public is asked to comment on the draft EIR. The lead agency is required to provide written responses to all of the comments received on the draft EIR during the public comment period. Other public involvement also occurs as required by various laws about public involvement in agency decision making. So there will be public hearings when the district is making a decision, and there's requirements for public involvement outside of CEQA at those times. What's the best way to comment on the notice of preparation? And you can see a few of these slides for one of the public committees, but it's good for all of us to know. The notice of preparation starts a 30-day public comment period on the notice of preparation. Public and agencies are asked to comment on the scope of the EIR. The notice of preparation will identify how to submit comments, what the email address is, or how to write in. Comments are most useful when they focus on the scope and content of the environmental information to be included in the EIR. That's the purpose of scoping. So comments should say, we think you need to cover this topic. We're concerned about that topic. We're concerned about these types of impacts. Unlike the comments on the draft EIR, there's not a requirement to provide written responses to the comments on the notice of preparation, and that is not done. However, the comments on the notice of preparation are usually provided as an appendix to the draft EIR so people can see them. Sometimes they're provided in the public during the comment period. And it is required that all comments on environmental issues that are received during the public comment period be considered in the development of the EIR. So we may identify that there were comments in the EIR, we may identify that there were comments on these topics, and these are addressed in this particular chapter. Next slide. So here's a diagram showing the sort of high level schedule for this, and I don't know, I hope you can read it. So where are we? We're off to the left of this. We haven't quite gotten to this this schedule. The first big schedule item is going to be recirculation of the notice of preparation. As project design has gone on, the district has chosen to recirculate the notice of preparation. It was circulated a couple of years ago, and at that time there will be opportunity for the public and agencies to comment on the scope of the EIR. There will be a public scoping meeting, and this is anticipated to be next month. Then we'll all go off and work on writing the draft EIR. It's going to require a lot of analysis, a lot of studies, and it's anticipated to be released to the public for review at the beginning of April. This says 2026, but that's a typo because I don't have a time machine. It's next April, 2027. Sorry. The public comment period is 45 days, and there may be a public meeting during that 45 days where people can hear about the process, or if the district decides, also provide comments. And then after the public comment period on the draft EIR, the final EIR is prepared. That's anticipated to be later in 2027. And then there's a process to certify the EIR and decision making and a notice of determination once the decision is made. Next slide, please. So I have a couple of slides here. They're pretty general, and so they, some of it doesn't apply, but they're about the process. So if you see here that it talks about the 30-day notice of preparation comment period, there's some stuff about contracts because CEQA applies to all sorts of different kinds of projects. And then it says public notice and review of draft EIR, 30 or 45 day minimum. That's what it says in the law. But if a project has statewide issues, it's going to be 45 days. And the CEQA does say, I was just looking it up, that it should not be more than 60 days, but 45 days is the standard. Next slide, please. And then here's some other deadlines. Once the district has received comments and has prepared responses, the district's required to send the written responses to comments by commenting agencies to those agencies for them to review 10 days before the hearing on a decision on the project. There is it's not a requirement. There's something in CEQA that says that final EIR ought to be certified by the lead agency a year from acceptance. The timelines in CEQA are not firm. They're not enforced. They don't have an enforcement mechanism, unlike you may have heard it with NEPA. NEPA has very strict timeframes. Notice of determination needs to be filed 5 days after approval in order to start a shortened timeframe for challenges to the EIR. And otherwise, it's 180 days for a challenge. And oh, commenting. Oh, no, that's fine. Next slide, please. Yes. Commenting on the draft EIR. So this kind of information will be provided at the time of the draft EIR also. But comments can be written, verbal, or email, depending on how the district decides to accept comments. Comments should focus on the adequacy and completeness of the draft EIR in describing the potential impacts of the project, as well as the level of severity of potential impacts. They should also look at the mitigation measures being proposed to reduce or avoid impacts and alternatives being considered. Comments can propose additional mitigation measures and additional alternatives if people and agencies reviewing the draft EIR feel that there are mitigation measures or alternatives that haven't been addressed in the draft EIR. The most effective comments on a draft DR are those that focus on the adequacy and completeness of the environmental analysis and are supported by factual evidence. Comments that focus on whether the project should be approved or denied are not comments on the adequacy of the draft EIR and fall outside of the CEQA process, but they should be considered by the agency. And usually those are identified in the responses to comments and forwarded to the decision makers for their review, but written responses are not made to those. And then this is a little bit more about response to comments. Lead agency must respond to the comments received during the public review period. There's no requirement to respond to late comments, but many agencies will consider late comments or will respond to late comments. I'm working on a project right now where the agency got some comments the day after the end of the period, and they decided they would consider those and they would also respond to those. All comments are part of the administrative record up until the decision. So even if they aren't received during the public review period and get a written response, they are part of the administrative record and need to be considered by the agency. Responses to comments are required to be good faith, reasoned responses. And usually the best responses are those that point the commenter back to where in the draft EIR the issues are addressed that the comment identifies. Hopefully we're not going to end up with comments that require new analysis. We're going to try to cover everything in the draft EIR. Responses to comments can include minor changes to the EIR. There's a process of being able to make minor changes or minor corrections up to a certain point without requiring recirculation of the draft EIR. And the contents of a final EIR are the draft EIR, all of the comments received on the draft EIR, the written responses to the comments, a list of persons or entities or agencies commenting on the draft EIR, and then possibly any new information added to the draft EIR by the lead agency, maybe some minor updates. The lead agency actions when approving the project are first certify the final EIR. And certification is that the final EIR complies with CEQA, reflects the agency's independent judgment, and that the decision makers are familiar with its content. I'm sure that your board is diligent in reviewing the environmental documents that come before you so that you know what you're acting on. Then the agency adopts findings describing what happens with the significant impacts and project alternatives. So these say these impacts are less than significant and here's why. These impacts are significant but reduced to less than significant by mitigation and here's why that is true. And then also here's what we're doing with the project alternatives. Sometimes a project alternative is adopted, but usually the proposed project is what's adopted, and there need to be findings about why the project alternatives that are evaluated in the EIR are not being adopted. And then finally, there's a requirement for a statement of overriding considerations for why it is that the agency is going to approve a project that has significant unavoidable impacts that can't be reduced to a less than significant level by mitigation. CEQA allows approval of projects that have environmental impacts. It's not intended to prevent projects that have environmental impacts, although CEQA does require, and this is different than NEPA, CEQA does require an agency to implement mitigation measures that are feasible. The statement of overriding considerations is where the agency gets to talk about the economic, social, legal, technological, or other benefits of the project that outweigh its impacts. These benefits aren't described in the EIR itself. They're described in the findings of when the agency takes action. And then finally, once a decision is made, the conclusion of the CEQA process is to file a notice of determination. Then, once the lead agency has acted, a responsible agency can use the lead agency's EIR. As I mentioned before, a responsible agency is obligated to use the EIR. They can't say, oh, we don't like that. We want to do our own. with except for the few exceptions. The responsible agency has to include in their project approval any pertinent mitigation measures from the EIR. However, they are allowed to require conditions within their area of jurisdiction. So an agency may be required to impose conditions of approval that respond to the law that they're enforcing. Then a responsible agency needs to adopt a mitigation monitoring and reporting program, just like the lead agency for the mitigation measures that they're required to include to address impacts under their purview. And they adopt findings of fact and statements of overriding consideration if necessary, and file a notice of determination as well. That's my overview. I'm happy to take questions if you have any.
Thank you very much. Do we have any questions from the board?
No, not there.
Yes, but I'll go last if you want to get some.
I was considering taking, since this is a single item, this report of taking public comment at the end of the reports. How many reports do we have tonight?
Three from an engineer, one from our community advisory committee chair, and one from myself. So four more.
Okay.
Five more.
So if there's any...
And another one.
And another one.
Wow. You're busy.
So I think for expediency, though, that if there are any clarifying comments or questions from the board to understand the presentation, we can take those now, and then we'll move on to the other presentations and then go through the whole public comment period.
Okay. I have some specific questions about CEQA that I'm curious about.
Sure.
Is that okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
All right. Thank you, Sally Zeff from ICF. I'm Craig Benson from the Harbor Commission. I got a couple questions. My understanding is that the offshore wind leases and transmission lines are completely different projects than the heavy lift marine terminal. But my question is, to what degree might NEPA for the offshore leases have any kind of nexus with CEQA, with the Humboldt Lift Marine Terminal? I'm assuming none, but could I possibly be wrong about that?
No, you're right. The CEQA process and the NEPA processes are separate processes. I mean, sometimes there's a preparation of a joint document if one project requires both types of processes. But no, the federal approvals for the offshore wind itself and transmission are separate.
Okay. My other question is, the Harbor District has been taking deep dives into and community involvement to discuss community benefit agreements. And I guess I'm just trying to get maybe your perspective on the difference between CEQA mitigations and community benefit agreements. Can they be used in concert with each other? Can a CBA be mitigation?
Sure. So we do have some other people from ICF helping the district with the community benefits agreement process, and they have a very different orientation because community benefits aren't necessarily about environmental impacts. They might be about social impacts. One of the key differences between CEQA and NEPA is that CEQA is concerned with physical changes in the environment that result in environmental impacts and not in social or economic impacts. And so there certainly are things that can affect people and communities that are not part, like jobs or the economy, that are not part of the CEQA process at all. And so the community benefits process can address those types of things that fall outside of the CEQA process. It may be that there are community benefits that are identified that also serve as mitigation measures if they're related to physical changes in the environment. Does that answer your question?
It does. Let me give you like a specific example. It's going to sound fairly whimsical, but I do mean it. What if a community benefit for the town of Samoa was to pay everybody's power bills for the next 20 years? Could that be done?
Well, I mean, the district, and I'm going to answer the question a little bit, but then I would leave the rest to your staff. But the district can decide to do anything it wants for a community benefit. So things like paying people's power bills or providing funding to a community organization, that could be a community benefit that the district agrees to do. That would not be an appropriate mitigation measure because that doesn't address a physical change in the environment. So it wouldn't be part of the CEQA process.
Okay, thank you. I just have one last question. Is there a pathway where this commission could certify that the EIR is complete and thorough and has proper mitigations and yet still deny the project based on overriding considerations? Is that something that happens ever? Or once we go down the path of certifying it and saying it's thorough and complete, is that sort of like saying yes?
No, it isn't. And I think you know, I think that's where you're going with that. That the CEQA process, as I said at the outset of my presentation, is not about approval of the project. It's about disclosure to the people and decision makers. So you could get to the end of the CEQA process, certify the EIR, and then wait and make a decision and make any decision that you wanted. I will note that, and I don't think this is what's going to happen. But CEQA does say if an agency is planning to deny a project, it does not need to do a CEQA document because denial is not something that's covered within CEQA because no impacts would occur. But it's relatively common in my experience for agencies to certify the EIR and then maybe take a break and think about something. Sometimes it's negotiations with developers when it comes to real estate development or some other thing. So the you can sever the two processes. You can get to the end of the CEQA process. Not the end. You can't do a notice of determination and you can't adopt the mitigation measures and the mitigation monitoring and reporting program, but you can get to certification of the environmental document and then decide what to do. Yes.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Commissioner Benson. Commissioner Newman, did you?
I'm more interested in hearing what the comments are on.
Okay, and then I have one question about CEQA that came up in the evaluation of the project. Do CEQA documents, do DERs ever evaluate the environmental impact of no project? And so, if there would be a negative environmental impact of not doing the project, is that ever part of the CEQA evaluation?
Alternatives are required to be evaluated in an EIR, and the evaluation of the no project alternative is required. And so, what the impacts would be of not taking the action are required to be analyzed in the EIR. They're not the baseline for decision in NEPA, and I keep talking about NEPA because, you know, the two are similar but different, and people hear about both of them. In NEPA, the effects are analyzed by comparison to the no action alternative. So you're looking at, well, what if we take this action and what if we don't take this action? And those are the impacts. In CEQA, the impacts of the project are evaluated compared to existing conditions and not the no project alternative. And in some cases, existing conditions and the no project alternative might be different.
Great, thank you. Appreciate the very thorough presentation. I think, what are the other presentations that we have and what order are they coming in?
So next we have Rachel Smith, Chair of the Community Advisory Committee, to talk about the meeting that happened last week, followed by Beth Burks of RCEA to talk about upcoming stipends, community engagement efforts beyond what we've done to date, and then Brett Vivian with GHG to talk about some engineering.
Great, thank you. So, Rachel, you're up next.
And unfortunately, Rachel sent me a number of photos that she wanted as slides, and I failed to get them up there.
No, it's fine. I've sent those if you wanted some pictures. What I did was send him a link to a Lost Coast Outpost article with pictures on it, so you all can look at that at your convenience. Oh,
Thank
thank you.
you, Mindy. I wanted pictures.
You're in luck because this is the first of a couple presentations we'll have about this community meeting. So I'm going to keep it fairly short tonight because there will be a follow-up presentation once the committee has had a chance to analyze and go over all the feedback and data that was collected at the public meeting. So for now, just because it was recent, we wanted to give a high level overview of what it was and how it went. So to back up, my name is Rachel Smith, and I'm a program officer with the Redwood Region. Oh, thank you. Yes, this is the article. So if you scroll that, you can just see that the meeting was very well attended. But I'm a program officer with the Redwood Region Climate and Community Resilience Hub, or CORE Hub. And we work with the work on the offshore wind stuff under the premise that if our region is to host these developments, it must be beneficial and avoid harmful extractive practices that we have experienced with development in the past. So that's the lens I bring to serving on my role as the committee chair of the Harbor District Convened Community Advisory Committee, which is a committee that is convened to represent the interests and concerns of the community in regard to this project, and to facilitate engagement between the Harbor District and community members. So this meeting was the first public meeting that was hosted by the CAC. Of course, the Harbor District has had a number of well-attended public meetings, but this one was a little different in that it was designed and hosted by community members serving on this committee. So when we were designing this meeting, the objectives that we came up with were to inform people about the project as environmental review moves forward. Like Rob mentioned earlier, since the loss of federal funding, there's been a public misconception that this project is canceled, and that's resulted in kind of a lack of public discourse, lack of urgency. So we wanted to get people thinking and talking about this again and more knowledgeable about it again, and communicate that this actually, as environmental review moves forward, this actually is a very important time to get involved. And we also wanted to collect feedback and questions and concerns from the public to inform our outreach. It's important in our role as community liaisons to understand how the community at large is feeling about this. So the meeting took place at the Arcata Community Center on Wednesday evening of June 24th. 222 people filled out the community of residence poster that was at the entrance. So that was where you could just mark where you were from. So that means that at least 222 people attended. They were mostly from Arcata, followed by Eureka, and then McKinleyville, and then Samoa. We designed the meeting, and the meeting went forward, starting with presentations, first by Tom Wheeler of EPIC to situate the project in a global context, what you also alluded to earlier, where the world is with the offshore wind industry, where California is going, and how this project fits into that. Then we had Shane Phillips of Moffitt and Nickel, who gave a project overview. And then we pictured it as a science fair. So you can see in these pictures, there was four different interactive stations, and people had the chance to just kind of mill about and interact with the materials, talk to the hosts of the stations, look at these visuals that are on display here from the meeting. And the interactive stations that we had were a community concerns and consideration station, a community benefit station, project design station, and an environment and CEQA stations. And each of these stations had a couple hosts. They were hosted by community liaisons who serve on the CAC alongside technical experts who are working on the project. So depending on what the community member approaching that station, what question they had or what conversation they wanted to have, there could be a back and forth of people with different perspectives and different knowledge about the project. And there are a couple methods to gather community input. So we wanted it so that there are people who really process verbally and want to just come up and talk, and there's other people who would rather write something down or put a sticker on a a poster. So we really wanted community input. So we wanted there to be multiple methods for gathering community input. And we also had it so that the community liaison hosts were supposed to be like writing down questions they heard. And if someone was telling them a lot of things that we wanted written on a board, but that person wasn't writing it on a board, we would write those things on the board. And so those questions are still going to be processed and presented to the CAC and then processed by the CAC. So we'll have data coming out of that meeting to present at a later date. And questions that were gathered live at the event were asked at the panel at the end. So like I said, we haven't really processed anything yet. So I don't have anything quantitative to share. So I'm just going to share some vibes. But so it was really active and busy. I didn't actually get a chance to mill about, check out the other stations and overhear conversations that was going on because I was talking the entire time at mine. It was just people and people and people, lots of participation and community feedback. And it really ran the gamut of opinions that there. I talked to enthusiastic advocates and staunch opponents and people with perspectives everywhere in between, a lot of people with questions. So some themes from my station and also from listening to the panel discussion were concerns from tribal people, concerns from aquaculture, lots of enthusiasm about clean energy and combating climate change, excitement about workforce development, questions about the health of the bay and the flora and fauna there, and concerns about the town of Samoa. So we actually haven't had another CAC meeting since this. So I haven't had a chance to debrief with the other station hosts and hear what their experience was and what conversations they may have had. But our next steps here is the raw data will be processed and presented to the CAC. We also hope that the level of knowledge in the community around the environmental review process has been raised and that you'll get a lot of good comments on the NOP document when it comes out in August. And the CAC will use the data to be better community liaisons and represent community interests. So that's what I have for you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
And any questions for a presenter from the board? All right, thank you. Then we'll move on to our next presentation on this topic.
All right, thank you very much.
Beth.
Hey, thanks. Hi, everybody. I'm Beth Burks. I'm the Executive Director of the Redwood Coast Energy Authority. And I want to talk about how we're doing. Great. We have been a sub already to create some tasks related to student and participation incentive selection and distribution. We're going to develop, it's not a catchy name. I know we didn't come up with a clever acronym for that. It's a mouthful. But basically, plan to equitably distribute stipends and incentives throughout the community for people, you know, like your communities that have been participating diligently in this over time. Also, there might be some educational opportunities, a wide variety of things. We want to host advocate tours and allow people to take those tours with a special narrative that those tours would not be at a cost. So quite a variety of potential incentives and participation. Developing a plan with some help from our legal team to make sure that whatever incentives and stipends we're providing comply with not only the grant requirements, but all kind of legal aspects. So we have a concern, you know, giving gift cards, does that make someone a staff member? Those kinds of things. So we have to evaluate, make sure when graces before we move forward. And we'll plan as a draft back to district staff starting in September. So we'll have time to revise that with district staff, keep them informed of how the plan's developing, and then from there we'll be responsible for implementing the plan. We have capacity to do that. One thing that's useful at our CEA is we use a service that helps us process payments in a little bit different way. We used to always have to do every kind of payment was a traditional check. But for people who are underbanked or otherwise not enthusiastic about banks, that can be a barrier. So we're looking into things like gift cards, but also that we could even do the documentation, like a Venmo payment or something like that. So we do have a lot of options available to us that we think will increase the ability to participate in a stipend or incentive, make sure that there's a barrier to entry there. So we're excited to get that plan underway. And like I said, we'll have a draft coming in September for your staff to review. I'm not sure if that comes back to your commission or if it's just a staff level review. We'll revisit that later, but we'll make sure to meet our deadline on that, get approval, and then implementation. The implementation of the incentives would go all the way through 2028, early 2028, so through that CEQA process that you just saw and beyond. We will be able to do some of this outreach regarding the incentives. We also have specific outreach planned in here and budget for that. So RCA already does quite a bit of tabling and outreach to all kinds of different communities that meet the definition of what we're trying to do based on your grant. So reaching historically, you know, folks that had limited access to this type of planning processes. So one efficient way we can do this outreach is by combining it with outreach our CEA is already conducting. So we spend a lot of time at senior resource centers. We spend a lot of time at family resource centers, you know, in addition to all the other big events like Friday Night Market and Farmers Market. But we also get food distribution events. And just sometimes we're out at different school districts in remote areas. So we can really, you know, bring offshore wind information heavy lift marine terminal information when we do this outreach and make sure that everyone has information at their fingertips. It's been made really clear to us that our role is not to necessarily promote the project, but to promote people increasing their understanding of the project and how they could get involved in the planning process. So that will be our mission as we carry this forward. So yeah, with that, I will say, you know, the sub award to us is about $550,000, and almost $400,000 of that will be passed through for stipends, incentives, and things like that.
Thank you very much. Clarifying questions from the commission?
Yeah, super heavy.
Yeah, and moving on to our final presenter, is that correct?
I'm presenting just after Brett.
Okay.
Brett, you want to advance your own slides?
Sure. Thanks. I'm Brett Vivian with GHD. I'm going to present a little bit just on updates for the class one trail that we're designing. The fence, kind of like the perimeter of the site, utilities, the solar array, and a little bit about the lagoons, but Rob is going to present more on that. So we'll start with the trail design. So we're at what we call 30% design. So, you know, a lot of where we are right now is to inform CEQA, which was presented previously. So enough to evaluate kind of impacts and inform mitigations and evaluate the components of the project. So the trail, it starts at LP Drive. And then this is a part of, and we followed design guidance for the Great Redwood Trail. So if you look at the Great Redwood Trail master plan, a lot of the language that I'll use is in that master plan. And that's what we formatted this after. This is a part of, it's within the Great Redwood Trail Agency's right of way, and a part of the Great Redwood Trail. So starting at LP Drive, and then following the right of way, all the way up to the northern entrance, so basically just past Cookhouse Road. But kind of some components along here that you see are some kind of access points along the way. So an access point, kind of Advance Avenue, where Recology is, and then it kind of goes along the entrance to the terminal site, goes right along the Phyllis Rex townhomes, and then there'd be a community access point located there, and then a community trailhead, kind of right, this is where the Samoa post office is located, and then kind of continue along the right of way with some access to the Peninsula Union School, and I'll give some details there, another trailhead kind of near Cookhouse Road, and then kind of terminating at the north entrance. So The trail is kind of divided into, I think of it as two kind of different design approaches. So from the Samoa post office south or left on your screen, then we are looking to do basically a rail to trail. So build the trail on top of the rail, and just kind of go through the center line there. There's no plans for use of that rail south of the post office. And then north of the post office, we have been coordinating with Timber Heritage Association. They run their speeder trains, and so we want to utilize the rails there. So the current design is to actually relocate the rail prism because to fit everything in there, but have basically the rail and then the Class One trail right next to it. One of the kind of community trailheads near the post office. So looking at kind of enhancing the parking and some drainage features just so you can get on and off the trail easily. And some I realize these are engineering drawings and just a bunch of arrows and text, but bear with me. But then at the Peninsula Union School, just enhancing that crossing of Vance so that students could be walking on the trail and then crossing over, but several locations just where enhancing safety and access. So this was just kind of like a general rendering that we were coming up with. There's going to be more outreach to the town of Samoa, but one of the big questions is like, what does that look like on the interface for the town of Samoa and the heavy lift marine terminal with the grade changes and kind of buffer, but you can kind of see the trail, the rail. And then a vegetated slope is the current kind of approach as to how to make that transition from one grade to the next. And then types of kind of looking at different perimeter controls, so or fences or walls. So thinking about those perimeter controls, we did look at other ports around the area and or not around not the area, but in California. I often refer to Port Hueneme. I was down there for a project and saw that. That is a budding a residential community, and they have kind of a wall. I believe that kind of doubles as a sound wall, but then also kind of screens the residences and kind of greens it up. Port of San Francisco, I realize, is kind of an industrial looking area, but more so just the type of fencing. This is kind of a nicer fencing. You see at a lot of ports, just kind of your standard chain link fence with barbed wire. But we are looking at kind of more ornamental fencing that still serves the same purpose. And then I did look at the New Bedford Commerce Terminal over in Massachusetts, which is an offshore wind facility. And so kind of looking at that, but that is kind of more of a standard, maybe a little nicer chain link fence around the perimeter. But we'll be more reaching out to the town of Samoa. We've got some meetings scheduled to kind of work with a landscape architect and the town to inform kind of what that interface looks like. Along the perimeter. And then there are just lots of different options for various kind of aesthetics of fence that also provide adequate security. And then entrance gates as well. There's a wide range of those at ports and what those look like. Really exciting stuff is utilities. Not so much, but what we're looking at is domestic water. So that'd be served by Humble Bay Municipal Water District. There's existing potable water lines out there. Fire suppression water. It would be using the potable water system. We did look at using the industrial system, but there's some pretty significant upgrades that would be needed for the industrial system, kind of all the way back to the source. So looking at potable water, using potable water and on-site storage tanks for fire suppression. Sewer. Will be served by Peninsula Community Services District. So there is a current wastewater treatment plant that went in just a few years ago. It's currently serving the Phyllis Rex townhomes and has capacity for the town of Samoa. We are working on a project to expand that wastewater treatment plant in the same footprint that's bringing on town Fairhaven and Fintown and kind of the commercial businesses, and is sized or can accommodate additional flows from the heavy lift marine terminal. And then allowing space for other utilities and, you know, kind of in coordination with them, but electrical served by PG&E, fiber optics by Vero Fiber Optics Communications. There's AT&T Communications out there, and then gas from PG&E. But again, those are the target. There is the 30% design, and to inform CEQA. So, you know, what's our footprint, and where do things go, and what's the location? The 30% design for the solar array. So that is kind of utilizing some unused space on the old contaminated sites where there were fill areas, and then putting a solar array on top of those hills or dunes. And so kind of getting to a conceptual or 30% design to be able to evaluate that and look at tie-in points for that to then serve the heavy lift marine terminal. Don't have much on the Samoa Lagoon site planning, but yeah. Next steps being stakeholder outreach, board considerations, and Rob will present a lot more on that.
That sounds
good. Just go right into the small guns.
Thanks, Brett. Just one correction. Brett said that these are on top of dunes. They're not on top of dunes. Dunes is an environmentally sensitive habitat area. We wouldn't put solar panels on top of dunes. These are closed wood waste landfill site. I've had community members say, hey, why are you guys talking about doing something on those dunes? But they are, it's wood waste from the old paper mill. And then the solar panels are on top of that. All right, Samoa Lagoons. So what I'm about to show you is not definitive. It's really just a concept, and we need to run this by a number of stakeholders, but wanted to share it with the board first. The only group that has seen this is the Town of Samoa Steering Committee that lives next door. So just be aware that this is entirely conceptual, and the point of this is to kind of get board feedback as to whether we should proceed with this idea any further. So just for context, there's the Town of Samoa. There's the heavy lift marine terminal project. That is the town of Samoa, including the townhomes. And that is the Samoa Lagoons. So if we zoom in on that, this is the Samoa Lagoons. It's a big berm with an empty bowl in the middle. So many decades ago, this terminal, Redwood Marine Terminal, when it was operational, needed to dredge to make this deep enough for ships to come in. And so they would suck dredge material out of the bay here, take it to that site. It would dewater and decant the water into the bay as mud, and then just leave behind dried dirt. And then dump trucks would come and take that sediment away and go use it for something else. And that would take about 400 dump truck trips to empty that of its 40 to 60,000 cubic yard capacity. The lagoons have not been used in this way for over 25 years, I think it is. So a quarter of a century just hasn't been used in that way. So the district has some options on what to do with this site. Chris and I have talked for years about trying to revitalize it, but there's not a lot of demand for that kind of use anymore. And so one thing we could do is try to reestablish it, but we're not sure that that's needed. Another one is to create a beach disposal and nearshore disposal rehandling ground, which I'll show you the idea of that shortly. Maybe environmental and ecological restoration to serve as environmental impact mitigation for the heavy lift marine terminal project. Maybe construction staging, and then maybe a leasable industrial laydown storage area was entertained. Fill it with solar panels or batteries, and then a recreational park, recreational facility. I'm just going to look at these this evening, but the point of this tonight is to show you what's possible and get your feedback on whether we should start asking other stakeholders as to whether dewatering area is really needed, and should we even entertain any other possible use at this site. So this is what I shared with the community here. So just looking at the site here, this is the parcel owned by the Harbor District. The Union School District is there, Timber Heritage Association. That is the entrance, the north entrance to the project site, and that is the planned Bay Trail. So just for context, what would fit here? That is 5 angled-in parking spaces. That is 85 angled-in parking spaces is a really efficient way to get parking to the site if you ever wanted to bring vehicles to the site. Those are crosswalks at scale. So if we zoom in, just so you know how I did this, those angled-in parking spaces, I just stole it from Old Town. I map at exactly the same scale and just slap them all on there. So this is really rough, but it's all to scale. Same with the crosswalks. They were stolen from some other crosswalks in town. That is the Arcata Visitor Center at the Arcata Marsh. This is the dog park in McKinleyville. That is the playground at the Arcata Community Center. This is the skate park in Eureka. That is the Wharfinger and its parking lot. This is the Eureka Corpyard, where they keep all of their equipment and vehicles and, you know, public works kind of pipes and wrenches and stuff. And that is the planned intersection improvements to the project site. So if we were to do anything that brought vehicles onto the site, we'd really have to coordinate with this intersection. So if we did the Wharfinger, there'd have to be an entrance. You don't want to offset the entrances and make a dangerous intersection. Probably too much detail for this presentation. All right, so I mentioned the Corpyard. The reason I brought that up is this type of facility, that size of facility, may be what is needed if we were to reutilize the site for beach disposal and beach handling. So if we were to pump materials from this project site to the dewatering area and decant it, right? That's the old style. But what we could do instead of the pickup truck or the dump trucks is go straight to the beach. And this would be primarily subterranean under the road, and wouldn't take this exact path. But you wouldn't need a facility much larger than this to rehandle and pump it to the beach. It's not really the perfect site for this. There's other options, but that's a possibility that we're entertaining. Another one is invasive species removal, restoration, riparian habitat, rare plants. So to scale, here's a couple of trees, native trees from, you know, across the street. So we could repopulate the site with native trees, throw in a bunch of trails that adds up to over a mile of trails there. And then there's this area that the Harbor District also owns, which is part of our on-site mitigation wetland restoration area. So that could be incorporated. We could think about adding some trails to that. So many other possibilities that we've talked about. As our executive director likes to point out all the time, it's fun and easy to plan for things. It's hard to maintain them and operate them. So if we were to do any of these things, who would own and operate the site? Harbor District obviously could continue to, but the Peninsula Community Service District could take on a park potentially. The county's got a lot of parks. We could dedicate this to a tribe and or other tribes. Friends of the Dunes operates these kinds of parks and restoration facilities. Bureau of Land Management's got a lot of land in the area, as does the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, maybe Cal Poly Humboldt, others. So for all these areas shown, we are running out of time to add this to the project and to the field studies. We're running out of time to add it to the permits in CEQA. Literally nothing I showed is allowed in the zoning. It is coastal dependent industrial. So the only thing technically allowed by the zoning would be a big industrial building. We have no construction funds. That's an important thing to point out. The ongoing O&M costs are something to think about. And then anything with buildings has a whole list of potential problems. Or challenges, I should say. Relatively easy would be restoration trails, maybe a dog park. Moderately difficult are, you know, these things here, small buildings and parks, and then anything with a substantial building is very difficult. In our current CEQA timeline, we could probably sneak in restoration and trails at this site, where these other things are becoming less and less likely, though we could probably do these at a programmatic level. And generally mention, hey, we're doing something with this site. We're going to do some initial studies, but any real project at this site would require CEQA amendment or a standalone CEQA process. So ran this by the Town of Samoa Steering Committee, which are representatives that live in the Town of Samoa that were self-selected by their neighbors to represent the neighborhood and to help work with the district in evaluating ideas. And I'd say this was generally favorable. We have at least one resident of the community in the audience who may want to speak to this. But this is very close to the school. Because of the trail that we'll be developing, you'll be able to walk from the Town of Samoa without crossing any streets to get to the site. So it could be a nice neighborhood amenity. Just for size comparison, this is the Samoa Lagoon site compared to a number of other parks in the area. So you can see it's very big relative to most parks. And we need to get a consensus from dredging related entities. Is dewatering at this site no longer needed? And want to start with the board. Should we even proceed to that step? If so, then the suitability of the pump station to get to beach disposal, talking to the Town of Samoa and their general needs. If we did the beach pump, it's totally compatible with the park. It wouldn't be used all that often. It would have some pumps. It would be noisy periodically, but generally they can coexist very easily. And then we need to meet again with the community and the tribes and the PCSD county others. And then we could start evaluating how realistic all of these concepts are and look to the future on O&M and what it takes to really keep this going. So that's the Samoa Lagoons. And then finally, here are the technical speakers coming up in the next 3 months. And I failed to mention during my director report that this is my second to last board meeting. August will be my last board meeting. I've accepted a position with the Humboldt County Association of Governments. I'll be starting there in mid-August.
Thank you. I guess bringing it first to the board for any questions on any of these. Technical presentations, engineering presentations.
Just a lot of options to consider. No, I don't have anything right away.
So it's my understanding with the Samoa Lagoons, like as a dewatering location, that there's not really a path forward for us to use it as it had been used in the past. It would take a lot of investment and a lot of upgrades, and there'd be a lot of regulations if we were to use it as a dewatering site again.
Yeah,
is that correct?
A lot of upgrades and a lot of permits is a path forward. So there is a path forward.
There is a path forward, and it's, but not as it was. It wouldn't just be pump the sediment, let it drain off into the bay.
It's not 1972 anymore.
Exactly. So, I mean, that limits the viability of the use of that use.
It could be lined. There's a number of studies. The Water Board has indicated that maybe it wouldn't have to be lined, but it would likely need substantial infrastructure investments, and our district engineers here could speak much more intelligently than I can about it, but he's probably aware of the general magnitude of what would be required to revitalize it. I think the more important question is it needed?
Mm-hmm.
Right, say we spend $5 million and we upgrade it and it is the best dewatering site on earth. Will anyone use it? Who needs 400 dump trucks of bay sediment a year?
The survey that you did for the
right. So seeking to do beneficial reuse, right? It's like, could we use this material to raise areas for sea level rise? So a couple of different times we sent out a request for information to all of the local governments in the region, the county, all the cities, a number of entities, including Caltrans. Could you use free fill material? And none of them really came up with any idea. The only possibility was a sea level rise project by the county, but what they really need is cobble, not bay sediment. So the material's really just not suitable for anything anyone has imagined that we have pulled to date.
Great. Thank you.
Except for sand, which is great for beach replenishment and maybe some filled projects.
Maybe I misunderstood one of the diagrams, but it looked as though it was a process of bringing the dredge materials to that area and then to the beach.
That's right.
Essentially, that's a booster pump operation.
Exactly.
So
you get it.
Yeah.
Okay. It would need that.
Yeah. That would be better suited at the south end of the RMT complex.
And since you did bring up that this is your second to last meeting, I don't want to spend too much time on it, but, you know, congratulations on your future endeavors, your new position. You're going to be sorely missed here. Although all the work that you've done here has been amazing with this project, moving this project forward. And I'm sure HCOG is going to be lucky to have you. You'll be missed. So with that, I'd like to open it up to public comment. I would like to point out that this is going to be a public comment period, not a question and answer period. I realized at our last board meeting, I did let it go with the technical speakers that we had, that there was a lot of interest and clarification needed with those technical speakers. And we are discussing ways to make our technical experts more available for that type of thing. But I've also been reminded that that's not an appropriate use of the board meeting for various reasons. So yeah, we're happy to entertain public comments. If people have questions, can coordinate with staff later to help get those questions answered. We do want to be transparent and communicative with the public in that way, but not entering into a back and forth question and answer period now. So with that, please come on up.
Thank you.
State your name, where you're from, and
okay.
What you'd like to say to us.
Okay, and I got 3 minutes. Give me a second here. Okay, I'm a resident of the town of Samoa. I live in 15th Bay Avenue, so that whole view is right in front of my house. Some considerations I would like to throw out is, first I want to mention that Craig Benson is now my new superhero. He said something earlier today or tonight that for community benefits, and that's I've joined the steering committee, the PCC, to get involved and to look at some of the community benefits, some of the benefits that the town of Samoa can have. I was part of a big project in San Jose when it went international. I've been in contractor, not I've been in construction for 40 years. I was a part of a program that reacousticized every home in a 5 mile radius around the international airport. And so I got to see at a young age that the windows, the siding, the roof, and where I got involved, because I'm an HVAC contractor, is they had to replace their whole systems, and that had to do with indoor air quality. So when I look at community benefits, I hope that somebody will consider, you know, the homes, even the townhomes with the windows, you know, soundproofing them, the lighting. There's technology out there that will shade windows now. And I would look at more community benefits that would help us where we're going to be affected the most. So that's just some consideration that I'd like to throw out there. Let's see. To what Rob was suggesting about the Samoa Lagoons, I see that as a great public benefit. Even though that the there's not money for the buildings, but I think, and if I'm not wrong, it kind of preserves that property, because then later on I don't want to deal with an industrial building that I'm not going to like, and so I'm very in favor of having that there. I'm not sure if the solar array is in the same area or if that was considered. I would like that to see that benefits us in the town of Samoa, and that's why Craig Benson is my hero, because when he mentioned that he would like to how can that benefit us and pay our bills, well, you know, there's some trade-off there, and so some consideration of that. The Redwood Trail, I'm not very in favor of it, because I'm dealing with a lot of stuff in front of my house and our community as well. I think the kids and the children, they need a safe pathway. You know, is that it? Do I have to stop?
You can finish your thought.
Okay. I think they need a safe pathway. I just want some consideration as is if this trail is in front of my house, and consider that if homeless are start to camp out there, who's gonna oversee that? There's a suggestion of a fence, and there's also to my understanding, there's probably a Homeland Security fence for the terminal. And then if your guys are suggesting another fence, there's two fences there. I mean, if I had to take the worst of, if I had to choose, I would choose them both, because I understand I wouldn't choose any fence, but I would choose a fence that would protect my neighborhood from people just coming on it. So that's consideration. I know that probably has to do with the planning department, and I'm in talks with the planning department that is showing concern for the town of Samoa. And I just want to be recognized and not get pushed to the side as just, somebody that just got walked over. And I'm representing not only the town of Samoa, but also the townhomes, because I think that no one's speaking it up. And I don't mean to say nobody. There's a lot of people that are involved in getting them involved in what's going on. But I'll leave it with that. And sure. Hopefully you guys, have some consideration of what I spoke.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Who's next?
I have a handout. Does that count as part of my 3 minutes, or I'd like to have something in front of you when I speak today.
Thank you.
And what I'm handing out at the top of the page there is one of the posters that was at the Arcata community meeting on June 24th that Rachel talked about. And then that was the last time we passed some of those around. Awesome. This is going to be part of what I'll talk about in just a minute.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate the chance to speak here. Like Brad, I'm a Samoa resident. I bought my home there 3.5 years ago. Without the disclosure that this particular project is in the works, although we did know it was a coastal industrial zoned. I'm sorry.
Could you say your name?
Oh, I'm so sorry. My name is Tina Manos, M-A-N-O-S. 5 seconds more. Okay. I love nature. I'm a proponent of green energy. I love our bay. I've been around the block, and I typically don't give my credentials, but I think it's important here because I'm intending to be here every month making a comment. I have an academic background. I have 2 bachelors, 2 masters, a doctorate. I've taught research and statistics for many years in different states. I've also worked in corporate America for a Fortune 100 company, where I was the second person responsible for the health, safety, and welfare of 15,000 employees across different countries. So I know the academic side, I can interpret the research, and I've also worked in corporate, and that's an insight that I think I can bring to this group, since we expect that the developer will probably be a large entity. We know Vineyard, for example, is a multinational corporation, and I've observed, done my own case studies to see how these things have worked in other communities. So I'm really here today to talk to the 5 people that are going to vote on my future, Rod's future, Jane's future, a few other people. Obviously, you are the local guys. You can be, as Rod said, our heroes, because unlike the other entities that will come in and are doing the reports and are from outside of this area primarily, and or the large corporations, you know the people, you know the economics, and you can smell the nature and see what is here currently, particularly for those of us who live in the community of Samoa, which is going to be greatly impacted. So I really have an ask of you today, and I'll continue to do this over the next few months. I'm going to ask that the data that is being presented be done so in a very unbiased and straightforward manner. And that happened not only with the lead agency work that you're doing on the reports, but also for what is displayed to the public as this entity, because it's my perception that there's been an overemphasis of the positives of this project and no real sense of the huge consequences for those of us that live in Samoa, the tribes, aquaculture, and that's what I'm here to speak to today. To give you one example, I mean, I have many examples related to my beef with the information and the way that things come down with regards to the noise expert what we've seen, what are the reports, and I'll talk about those next month if you want to hang on. But today I'm just going to start with a small item that's really important. If you look at the graphic that's in front of you, this was one of the posters that was presented at the June 24th meeting. And I'm going to make some assumptions here. This poster is entitled Offshore Wind Terminals in Action and the Affected Communities. Do I have zero time? Oh.
Yeah, what's the 3 minutes? I'll permit you to go ahead and wrap up
Okay,
what
if you
your
take a look at the data that's out there for Connecticut, for Virginia, for, excuse my French, Port La Nouvelle, those are not comparable facilities. If we translate the distances that are presented there into distances that are relative to what happens in Samoa, you'll see that the closest home, the wall of their house, I don't know how these measures were taken, but the wall of their homes are, in the case of the Rex townhouses, 62 feet away. What is it, 80 or 90 feet away for the people that live in Samoa? The turbines, their heights, the amount of construction, and the equivalency of the projects that are being compared in the public and for the decision makers, I think is biased. And this happens in a number of instances for the data that's presented so far. So I hope there'll be opportunities to come challenge and show you that there are different viewpoints so that fair comparisons can be made and you can realize the impacts that will be quite severe to our community. And I just say, I can't see how you're going to mitigate it. I just hope that these community benefits can be beyond superhuman, given the, as the LA Times would say, the audacity of this huge project. So.
Thank you. Any additional public comment? Do we have anybody online wishing to make public comment? I see a hand up.
Hi, everyone. Jennifer Cult with Humboldt Water Keeper. I was sorry to hear that you won't be doing the Q&A because that last meeting I thought was the most substantive meeting about this project that there has been overall in the last several years. So I will reform my questions into comments. My comments are that I would like to request that Sally Zeff do a presentation in the future if she can't answer these questions now, addressing whether NEPA applies to the offshore wind terminal, when will NEPA be done for the terminal, and why it's not being done concurrently with the CEQA process as it normally would be done in this type of a situation. My understanding is that there is no NEPA lead agency for the project, and maybe I'm wrong about that. If you want to correct me now and tell me that there is, that would be great. But thanks for considering the idea of having future or current answers to those questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any additional public comments?
Can I speak for my wife?
Pardon me?
Can I speak for my wife?
I'm not involved in your marriage. I don't know if you're a wife or not. Okay, bringing it back up to the board, I would like to follow up on Jen's question. Where is NEPA fitting into the CEQA or into the timeline? I know it's not part of the CEQA process, but where is it fitting into the timeline?
I'm hoping Sally is still with us, and she would probably need to be re-unmuted. She is. Generally, what I'm going to say is that there is no NEPA nexus, so there has to be a nexus to trigger NEPA. We had federal funding. That was
the benefit
nexus
of not having federal funding is
right.
We're not doing NEPA.
Right. We are not on federal lands. Multiple people have brought up the federal navigation channel, which would trigger NEPA, but we are not modifying the federal navigation channel, despite what seems to be a persistent misunderstanding throughout the community. We are doing a U.S. Army Corps 408 permit because we are dredging up to the navigation channel, but we are in no way modifying the navigation channel and from end to end, not the entrance, not front of our project, not the turning basin. So there is no NEPA trigger. Hopefully, Sally can give you a better answer than that.
I am still here just for this purpose. And Rob gave you a great answer. NEPA applies to federal agency actions. And because there's not federal funding, this is not a project on federal land, there's not a federal agency action. However, there will be permits required from, say, the Corps of Engineers. They will be taking actions, but those agencies will do their own NEPA, following their own procedures. So there's not a requirement for the district's consideration of the project to have NEPA. Are there questions about that?
No, I thought that was
Good.
pretty clear. Were we to get another big federal grant, I guess we'd have to revisit that, but for
For what it's worth, before we got the federal grants, we contacted the U.S. Army Corps and said, "Hey, we want to do NEPA. Will you be our lead agency?" And he said, "There's no nexus. You're not triggering NEPA. We can't be your lead agency." So then we asked, we said, "We're anticipating getting federal funding. So just be our lead agency now so we can do a joint NEPA CEQA document. We're getting started on CEQA." And they said, "No, till you have a nexus, we're not going to be your lead agency. And if you get federal funding, then your federal funding agency would be your lead agency." For a minute there, MARAD was a federal funder, and we were going down the path of NEPA lead agency. But that ended with the loss of federal funding.
well, just a point of clarification about CEQA and NEPA, that my understanding from the presentation of, maybe I'm wrong, but that CEQA was adopted in the 70s after NEPA and was modeled after that, but maybe added a few more considerations to make it more, I guess, considering the effects on the community. I think that was the difference.
Yeah, here's maybe a way to answer that. I don't know the exact percentage, but somewhere around 90 to 95% of CEQA and NEPA are effectively identical. And so one of the deliverables that I have required ICF to prepare is a memo to the district that says, if NEPA is ever triggered, here is where your CEQA document is inadequate and what you would have to add to it. But the rest would be able to be copy and pasted over to the NEPA document. So we will have a guidance memo of a roadmap on what to do if NEPA is ever triggered and how to take our CEQA document and enhance it to become a NEPA document.
And just to add, NEPA has been experiencing so many changes lately that who knows what a NEPA requirement might be for whatever federal agency is going to be granting permits for this project. And so you're better off waiting until some federal agency says we have to do it. And the Corps often wants to do their own. They don't want you to do it for them. They're generally resistant to doing NEPA on anything that isn't within their approval authority. So that there's no value really in trying to prepare to do NEPA in the future. But as Rob said, part of our scope of work is to identify how all of the work that we're going to do for a CEQA can be used to support a NEPA document in the future.
Thanks. Yeah, are there additional comments or questions from the board?
While I understand the legal reasons why there's not a nexus between this, we've often described this project as a three-legged stool that involves offshore wind leases for the deployment of these turbines that could be integrated here, the heavy lift marine terminal, and the third leg of the stool, being the transmission lines. And it seems that we have this way of taking an entire body and separating the arm from the leg, and to divide these, and they're being done in different time scales, et cetera. I get all that, but it also doesn't sit well with me. I just have to say, it seems like an avoidance of the cumulative impacts of a mega project, by dividing it into thirds, in a way that doesn't acknowledge the synergy and the cumulative impact of all three of these projects that are inextricably linked, and no one of these projects has value without the other ones. I'll just leave it at that. It's more of a comment than a question.
Well, I would like to agree with the comment, and I feel the same way. I, as a full-time commercial fisherman, my crew line loaded 8,000 pounds of fish this morning. Very few boats left that are actually working, but all these three components that you just mentioned could desperately ill affect fishing. But my community prosperity advocate part of my brain and my presence as a commissioner is all for the pros. So I just want you folks to know I'm listening and am part of a divided community that can see a lot of benefits and a lot of possible negatives. So just to let you know that decisions aren't made yet. We're learning and listening. At least that's how I feel. Thanks.
Thank you. Rob, did you have a...
just wanted to point out this technical speaker schedule ahead of us isn't, it's tentative. These aren't all fully confirmed, but the one I'm really excited about is next month, Green Terminal, Dark Sky, Electrical Load Demand. Thanks to Matt Simmons from Epic, who's here in the audience, we got connected with Dark Skies International, which is an organization that certifies projects to minimize their lighting. There's one port in the U.S. that is certified as a dark sky port. That is the Port of Miami. And the person that designed that entire lighting system is our lead lighting designer for this project. And he'll be presenting next month. And so I'm really excited for those presentations.
Thank you. And like I mentioned before, we, you know, we don't have any suggestions or solutions yet, but we do want to find a way to make it more available to have some of these technical experts for a more community engaged discussion. That would probably have to be at something separate than the board meeting.
Workshops or
something like that. So yeah, we don't have anything.
I just consulted with counsel. I want to address the comment that we received and what you're discussing. So it is the intent of staff to hold a monthly community meeting with technical experts that the community can come and ask the questions that they're asking to be asked. So it's not that we're looking to eliminate it from our commission meetings. We're actually looking to enhance that and go a step further. We'll have our monthly meetings. We'll have a terminal update in the meetings, maybe not as inclusive as what we're having now. We will have a monthly commission or community meeting with the technical experts that commissioners can be present at to answer questions so that dialogue can occur and not be prevented. So more to come on that, but I think you'll find a very positive announcement quite soon. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Chris. I wasn't sure how much of that we'll say or not. We're definitely working on it. So with that, this is not a voting matter. It was an information matter. So thank you very much for all the great information. There's more Harbor District business to come. Thank you very much, Beth, for coming and sitting there with that. But we're going on to the Conflict of Interest Code of the Harbor Bay Recreation and Conservation District. Everybody doesn't want to stick around for that one? All right, so moving on to new business review of the ordinance of the Ordinance 8, Conflict of Interest Code of the Humboldt Harbor Recreation and Conservation District.
Yeah, thanks. I'll take this one. So the district has adopted by ordinance, as required by California law, a Conflict of Interest Code. The district has, like most jurisdictions in the state of California, adopted the model ordinance that is prepared by the Fair Political Practices Commission, which incorporates by reference any changes that are made to the model ordinance. Every 2 years, the district is obligated to review its conflict of interest code and determine whether any changes are necessary. I've reviewed it. The disclosure categories remain correct. The designated filers remain accurate. And so I'm not suggesting or recommending any changes. If the commission agrees, we would simply let the county know that we've reviewed it and determined that no changes are necessary, and we are off the hook for another 2 years until we will do this again.
All right, thank you. Any questions or comments from the board on the conflict of interest code?
Read it and no questions.
Yeah, do you need some kind of a vote or decision?
Yeah, we'll go to the public first, and then I think we make a...
We do need a motion.
Yeah. So any comment from the remaining public on our conflict of interest code? Seeing none. Do we even have any public online still? Oh, we do, yes. All right, I'll entertain a motion.
Second it.
Okay, I have a motion and a second. This is a resolution or anything, so all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed or abstain? Motion passes. And another status update is on maintenance dredging of Woodley Island Marina.
Done.
All right, cool.
The room out last night in honor of Uncle Pat.
Issue us all 5 gallon buckets and send us out to there.
Shovel, yeah. We're going clamming. Okay, so well, I expected to see quite a bit of the fishing fleet here tonight. At least we got one local fisherman. I'm going to use some historic graphics because this paints the exact narrative that we deal with on nearly an annual basis. There's been a lot of questions in and around the island community over the past several months. When are we dredging next? Is there a plan to dredge? We have a significant challenge between G and H and H and I in terms of fairways. Fairways, again, or the waterway areas in between different docks or floats. This bathymetry survey is a contour survey. This isn't what's used for dredging, but it's a good illustration of what's out there in terms of how the sediment mounds and where it mounds. The darker colors are much greater depths, with the lighter colors being shallower depths. This might give you a little bit better inkling of what that looks like. The prior graphic is essentially the marina with a contour with the float system removed. And we dredge to different depths based on mean low, lower water. This just gives you a little bit better broad view of the marina as it sits and the different areas. So we have the breakwater, which is the far west side of the marina, and then docks A through I, okay, with a fairway in between each. This is from the last dredging episode. This was a severe dredging episode because it had been some time since we were able to dredge. And while we were doing some periodic dredging, we weren't able to get ahead of or catch up to the need. We also had some very severe winter storms just prior to this particular episode. So we removed 64,753 cubic yards of sediment. The table just after the dredge areas is the Drethelow mean lower water, which is an average of these low tides over a period of time. So we dredged to 14 feet below that as a dredge depth at breakwater, all the way over to the west side of Sea Dock at 13 feet, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, over to H&I docks. So what is kind of the plan when we dredge? We take those areas specifically and we create polygons or dredge areas. And then we work with our contractors to bid specific to those areas and work to certain dredge steps based on where we need deeper, shallower water. So this is, again, taking back a look what we need to remove, just taking the marina into specific dredge areas and laying it out for the purposes of bid and then operations. So this is what we did in the very last episode. Areas 6 and 7, which are on the far right, these are these areas I'm circling now with the cursor. These are our real challenge areas. These are more than shallow water. On a low tide, the elevation is positive in these areas, above mean low, lower water, not to mention what a dredge depth would be. So if you moor on the inner reaches of those fairways, you are stranded, and oftentimes your vessel sits in mud, as do the district's facilities. This is an incredibly challenged area. Equipment that's been brought in here is not of a size that can fit in those areas, nor is the swing in the reach of the clamshell, which is essentially the excavator that removes the material, able to navigate in those areas. Based on the heights of masts on vessels, even though they're moved, there's enough real estate that we can't move the adjacent area. So oftentimes we're in the reach or the pilings that are holding the dock system anchored to the floor. So in that particular dredge episode, this last one, we dredged 64,753 cubic yards. The bid that we accepted was at 3,750 a cubic yard. However, there is a large mobilization that you'll see here. And that combined with a few other costs has brought the dredge bid to $3.5 million. Okay. This was for 64,753 cubic yards. This was a successful dredge episode done in 2324 and 2425, speaking fiscal years. They were done in the 2324 years. Excuse me, 2425 years. So looking at Woodley Island Marina, an estimated dredge episode volume and cost. So a typical year's removal is approximately 45,000 cubic yards. If we were going to dredge on an biannual basis, we're probably removing about that amount of material. The estimated cost today per cubic yard, adjusted for inflation, that $55 is about $60.24. The estimated cost per episode then is $2.7 million, $2,711 to be a little bit more round. And our annual dredge fund collection, I'm going to say connection, is only $250,000. And so if we really look at this and we adjust this for, this is an adjusted average for inflation, it would take us about 11 years to save up money. And by that point, it would cost us $3.7 million to dredge. So if we were to rely just on our collection, our dredge fund, we could dredge once every 11 years. And that would be adjusting up almost $90,000 divided over the slips here in Woodley Island Marina. Not going to be favorable with our occupants. But that's the harsh reality of what we're looking at and when we could dredge. It's a very honest slide. It's what the need sits at right now. So this is why we aren't dredging. As a reminder, when we dredged just 2 years ago, the district borrowed about $3 million, $3.5 million to dredge and use some existing funds, bringing the dredge fund balance to a negative level. And I've requested an audit of that fund right now to make sure that we've posted the prior liability we had by not appropriately using those funds, the adjustment for the borrowed funds, and then the dredge expense. And I have no reason to believe it isn't accurate, but it's important that we look at that and make sure what our fund balances are so we can estimate what we have to move forward with. I mentioned just a few minutes ago that in 2022, 23, we were working with FEMA because we had some very severe winter storms. And it brought in almost $20,000 of excess sediment. We were found to be eligible for disaster funding through FEMA and began the very long and lengthy process to get through that, many times coming close to funding, finally agreeing on what the cubic yards they were going to pay us for. And then there was a sudden change in the federal government. It was something called an election. And as we sit right now, FEMA funding is completely shut down. It's only for immediate loss of property or life. So questionable when we're going to be getting those funds. That doesn't mean that SHN, our district consultant, Natalie McLaughlin, does not continually stay in touch with them, or the district staff doesn't continually stay in touch, respond to them because we're getting recurring requests. But that is a dependency to pay off that loan so we can even consider some options. So what's next steps and what is staff researching? Well, we're looking at infrastructure loans, but these would have to be perpetual or refunded frequently. And refunding doesn't always bring a large volume of excess funds. Typically, we're responding to the market. Can we lower? Can we amortize? Can we lower the rate? Can we take what we've paid down in principal? And how much principal will that give us? That is an exhaustive exercise. It's extremely expensive, but it is one potential way to generate and leverage funds. That is a type of municipal bonds. There's other types of municipal bonds out there, such as an infrastructure bond. We can do an enterprise fund bond like we did back in 2023. There's tax options. We can look at what kind of tax assessments can be issued or what kind of tax options can be sold. We could increase the user assessments. Increased user assessments are the most common way to dredge right now, but it makes costs of mooring vessels and operating within marinas extremely expensive for the users. We can look at government grants and funding options. There are some out there for the purposes of recreation and navigation. In fact, there are vital and recreational infrastructure grants potentially coming up in this next round of funding at the federal level. California Natural Resources, Boating and Waterways has not made any announcements. There's navigation and marine safety grants. This is something new that's come out. Some of this is through NOAA, some of it's through the Homeland Security, some of this is through Army Corps of Engineers. Unfortunately, the current administration has made this kind of an on-hold item. Don't know the outcomes of that and what it's going to look like. But we are the home port to the United States Coast Guard. And so we have reached out to the U.S. Coast Guard for support. They've made mention of support. I don't know if that means just end ties for their vessels. I think that could be what it is. Or is it going to help us more on a broader scope? It's important to know that we do sit partially in the Federal Channel. So we've asked the U.S. Army Corps for what sort of assistance could come from them. And by the mapping and the determination of the site, is there any responsibilities they would have, or will we have the ability to use their assets or work with them to make permitting more attractive, the frequency more attractive, to lower costs? They're mobilizing on an annual basis. That might be a fantastic way for us to piggyback, if possible. Highly unlikely, but it is unique that we sit in the Federal Channel. And that mapping was never closed. So we've asked for that to be looked at. These are options. We're just bringing this to you because there's been a lot of requests. The sad message is we aren't going to be dredging this season, but that doesn't mean that on a recurring basis, we're not in touch with agencies. We're not looking at options. We're not considering our finances and looking at ways to do so. Not the best report, but it's one that was important that we brought through to you. Sorry, I didn't mean to roll right to adjournment.
Thank you. I'm also disappointed we don't have a patch here to comment on the dredging item, but
That's the Roomba comment.
any comments or questions from the board on this report?
So the what is the composition of the $250,000 dredging fund annually? Where does that money come from?
You.
That's just surcharges for
It's the
dredging?
dredge surcharge. That is correct. Those that are inside the marina, there are some that apply to fields landing boatyard that are levied specific from the occupant down there. But
Prior to the last round of dredging, that fund didn't even exist.
it did.
So,
It was spent, not to correct you, Commissioner, but it was spent elsewhere.
the actual surcharges that appear on the bills, though, didn't exist until fairly recently. So, I know that we always have to find money to do things. So, I'm just assuming that there's more avenues at our disposal.
Do you have recommendations or thoughts on that?
Well, just buy more money. Make a bigger, just make my
I'll be able to shake your couch
make
cushions for you.
Well,
our tenants' dredge fund a bigger part of their already paid bill.
understood.
If we were
Thank
to
you.
hypothetically bring in a large industrial user on district facilities and increase boat traffic, could that increase our revenues to be able to allocate some more money to
They likely wouldn't
dredging?
be a user of
Now,
bulk.
yeah, would it have to be a user of like Wood the Island Marina, or just by bringing in more revenue to the district, could we allocate more funds towards things like dredging that like our responsibility as a district to do?
So two answers to that. One is they're not going to pay into a dredge surcharge unless they're anchored here at Woodley Island. However, ship traffic coming in and out of the port, and depending on what they're bringing in out of the port, could rather handsomely affect revenues to the district. But it would have to be a large scale increase, and it would have to be recurring. So the ships would have to be coming and going. And it's not just the harbor use charge, but the tariff schedule. That's where revenues really could start to grow. So it's what they would be bringing in and out of the water. And there is some things on horizon. We received a solicitation today from NOAA, for example. And in that solicitation, they're very willing to look at. I happen to be aware of this. I was on a meeting a while ago. The solicitation finally came out. They happen to be very willing to participate in costs related to activities in the harbor because they plan to come and go quite frequently. And they understand that there are charges and surcharges. They're using that as an attraction to receive our proposals from people that might want to anchor them. We actually qualify for everything on there on the face sheet, other than we need to be 150 miles from an international airport. I plan to submit that we are 1 air hour away from an international airport because 150 miles in a German car is 3 hours. We can get there by air in 1 hour. I'm hoping we can explain that in a narrative that will get attention.
And occasionally our flights leave.
Well, I'm not going to include that, Commissioner.
I mean, just driven back from San Francisco.
But this is what we're doing in that. I mean, we're literally put our name out that we're receiving solicitations now that we once were
I guess what I'm
not.
saying is, so it doesn't have to actually be funds that are
That is
specifically
correct.
tied to dredge. Like if we just increase our revenues, and obviously I was also thinking of the heavy lift
Harbor
marine
fees are
terminal.
revenues of the district that will go to ultimately to the general fund.
And I know we have other things to
Right.
pay for as well, but this is one of
Keep in
our
mind, we
lowest priorities.
haven't negotiated leases yet for operations, so we don't know what strings may be tied to those funds or what other requirements may be there. One of the biggest things that we need and we don't have here currently is a vessel traffic management system, and that's prohibiting us from having some of the statistics that would help us go after these grants. We have an upcoming meeting on that topic because there are a number of groups out there that have developed things outside of VHF, which is really how we manage the bulk of our, we know what's coming in and out of our port. But there are a number of things now with Starlink and other services and applications where they're getting pretty good at knowing who's coming in and out of. And even VHF now can be
AI
converted to
services.
apps and whatnot and certain services. Once we have that traffic, we may be a much more attractive port in terms of going after smaller programs. Sometimes it's just technical assistance to get the exposed experts on this stuff that can find programs for us or write very competitive applications.
Not to labor this, but the historical perspective that I have on this is having been president of the association for the local fishermen association back in 2007, I lobbied for dredging. Back in those days, there was no dredge surcharges. They started when we hired Jack Kreider to be executive director, and the first time I was on the board here. I guess my question is, back in those days, did we use more of the funding from our county assessments, or was there just more funding available from shipping? Because there was more commerce back in those days, we had like 25 ships a year rather than five. I'm just wondering where, because back then it was still very expensive to bring in a dredging operation that operated for a significant amount of time. I mean, they used to remove a lot of material, but they piped it on the beach.
Yeah, I think that
So
so maybe just the cost,
maybe
one
costs
aspect of the cost
and.
has gone up just because of the methods and the permitting that we have to
So
use
that's a
now.
lot of the story. It's the costs.
I don't know the answer,
I'm
but
assuming.
that's my assumption. That having to do it with a clamshell and ship it out, barge it out to Hoods is probably the to channel our former commissioner is probably the stupidest way that we can dredge and most expensive way we can dredge, but that's the way that we're forced to do it.
Well,
He was brilliant. Sorry.
I'll do my best to answer your question. Clearly, costs are much greater than they were, right? Now, we have not done an analysis to what rents were then and what rents are now, and perhaps that's a negligible number. Yes, mobilization is $1 million. We don't have the assets here because we don't have the volumes and the activity that we once had. Keep in mind, in those activities, a number of folks were dredging, including private terminal owners. The size of ships that were coming in required different dredging. The amount of support vessels was very different. The amount of fishing vessels that were active and the amount of rents being paid in proportion to the expenses were far greater. There's probably 30 plus slips vacant in this marina at any given time. 30 small vessels doesn't add up to a lot. 30 large shipping or fishing vessels, they're a lot bigger. They're much bigger berths. So, yeah, it's a different revenue source in terms of what's coming in and a much larger cost. It's probably not true that it's less expensive to do suction dredging. I think that's a myth that we talked ourselves into, quite frankly, because it still has to be disposed of. In fact, it could be more costly because with a suction dredge, likely we would be pumping that material. Remember, what's in the marina is not suitable for reuse, or as of today, is not suitable. So we'd be simply handling an additional time to take it somewhere. So while we psychologically tell ourselves there's cost savings there, either we put it on a dump scow and we go dump it at Hoods anyways, or we take it to dewatering basin and we handle it multiples of times. So the cost is there one way or another. We might just see it over time versus in a one-time charge.
Plus one smell mitigation.
Yeah, thank you. Not to mention what it would cost in an upfront investment to do section judging. Great point. The final thought on that is, yes, I think you're right, Aaron. I think that at one point in time there was way more activity, and so the revenues to the district were far greater. We're a long ways away from that. Assuming the heavy lift marine terminal is a viable project and it happens, there isn't a market for it today. There isn't Vineyard Wind or RWE or Equinor aren't coming to us and saying we want to sign an agreement with your facility. Nobody's coming today and saying we want to build this facility. There's a very large wait and see kind of wait out where we sit today. We don't have transmission lines, so even if we were ready to build it, we don't have a pathway to get it there. These aren't negative comments. These are honest comments and honest assessments. We have a very large window in front of us that this is a time-sensitive problem. And so we're going to have to look at creative ways to deal with it today in hopes that we will have these large revenues in the future. So that perpetual up there, infrastructure loans, or a constant refunding for a very small margin doesn't have to happen. And I fear if we get in that process right there, it isn't only expensive. It will be hard to retain people because that is an exhausting program. I'm not just talking about staff, I'm talking about consultants as well. That's all always going to work for a very low margin. You can always add something.
We are using some of our tax funds for dredging
Yeah.
because we've used the tax funds to pay the loans. So we have earmarked funds for that back under Larry, but those funds go now to paying the loans rather than for future dredging.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. I wasn't expecting
And that is on your budgets now, as you know, we have that.
Any
We
more from
highlight
the
those.
public care to make comment on this?
No ideas, James?
Not talking.
Well, continue to shake the trees and dig through the couch cushions, but I don't know, maybe the idea of a bond or something like that is potential. I know there's a lot that comes with that though too. So.
More planning.
All right. If there is nothing else, then we are adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
When did you say your special meeting? July 6th.
Next Thursday.